8:30 a.m. on October 4th, and I called the meeting of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. The meeting is being held virtually via Zoom, and the public has been properly notified of the options to attend and observe the meeting. Ms. Poe, will you please call the roll?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Medina?
Present.
Dr. Stewart? Oh, Dr. Stewart, you're muted. I see you there.
Present.
Thank you. Dr. Catarino?
Present.
Dr. Davey?
Present.
Dr. Flint?
Present.
Dr. Seidman?
Present.
Dr. Stenhoff? We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. Number three, remarks and announcements. Please keep in mind that the times stated on the agenda are approximate. The board makes every effort to begin proceedings at the scheduled time. The board may suspend the discussion of one agenda item, proceed to a timed item, and then return to a former agenda item at a later time. The board may also reorder non-timed items. Board members, thank you for continuing to use the raise hand feature of Zoom because I think it facilitates the meeting quite a bit. Board survey, the board encourages everyone in attendance to provide feedback by completing the board assessment form. You'll find a link to the meeting agenda that is posted on the board's website. I want to take this moment to appreciate all of the hard work and effort that the board members put into getting prepared for these meetings. Thank you for your hard work. And I also want to thank our board staff and our attorney general for their hard work. They spend many, many hours on this. And, you know, it takes a village to put meetings together, and they are our village. So thank you. Continuing education credit. Board meeting attendance is eligible for continuing education credit if it is at least 4 hours long. But this meeting is not going to be longer than 3 hours, probably because of quorum limitations. So thank you for your understanding. I want to take this time to share some news, regrettable news that the board received. Mr. Nguyen has stepped down from the board as a board member. And I think I speak on behalf of everybody when I say that he has left a lasting impact on the board. He was a valued board member, and, you know, we all, at least I personally, enjoyed working with him quite a bit. And, you know, he brought that that special perspective that I think a public member always brings to the board. On a personal note, that leaves me as the only public member, so I'll probably share some words with Mr. Nguyen when I see him in person, but, you know, just trying to inject some humor in the proceedings. So yeah, we really want to thank Mr. Nguyen for his contributions and for being such a good sport. Call to the public. We will take that at a later time because we are sort of rearranging some agenda items, and you know, we'll probably jump around quite a bit. So please, bear with me. Council update. Ms. Galvin, do you have any updates?
I do not at this time. I will say that the matter involving Jamie Jones, behavior analyst, we do have a settlement conference before the administrative law judge today at 11. So I will be hopping off to cover that, but then we'll update the board.
Thank you, Ms. Gavin. So number six, consent agenda. I'll note that since Dr. Catarino would be recused from what would be typically our 6A, which is the minutes of the board meeting, we decided to remove that agenda item from this meeting. So, you know, those meeting minutes would be at the next available meeting when we can vote on that. Any other recusals? I believe Dr. Medina has a recusal.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I recuse from 6E.
Thank you. Any board member may wish to remove an item from the agenda for a separate discussion. Is there any such request? Yes, Dr. Catarino.
I just wanted to have a little discussion on Dr. Smith, because typically we give 1.5 times extra time, and this person asked for 2 times, double time, just I think that maybe we need to decide when we do double time, when we do one and a half, or is it at the discretion of the applicant or the physician or us or what?
Okay, so that would be 6D, which will be removed from the consent agenda and will be separately discussed. Is there any motion to approve the remaining items on the agenda?
So moved.
Right, Dr. Medina's motion, and okay. I believe Dr. Stewart's second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
None opposed, the motion carries. So then let's go actually to number 11. I know we'll come back to 6D, Dr. Caterino. We have Dr. Davey for a limited time, so I want to make sure that we can cover items that for which we'll need him. Dr. Flint, you have your hand up.
I am recused from item 11, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. So on 11, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding substantive review of applications for psychologists, EPPP, and or licensure. And Dr. Medina is the lead on all three listed items. 11A is Paige Wilcox, PsyD, EPPP, and licensure. And Dr. Medina, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Wilson received her doctoral degree from Midwestern University, an APA-accredited program. She completed her internship at the JPS Health Network in Dallas, Texas, which is an APIC site. I did have some questions when I was looking at the file because in the APIC listing, it says that they're not APA accredited. But in the internship verification, they check that they are APA accredited. But then in the internship verification, they went on to fill the all the last items as if they were non-APA or APIC members. So clearly I can see that the site is an APIC member site. I believe it's not an APA accredited site. So being APIC, it's meets that requirement. It's just the form was confusing. She submitted 2,021 hours from her internship and 1,192 hours from pre-internship sites. Her hours, direct contact, and supervision all looked in order, and the self-query was submitted as well. I don't know if just because the internship form was filled out in a confusing way, it's a reason to request that to be corrected.
You could make a motion to approve upon the receipt of a corrected.
Okay. Yes. So I will make a motion to approve upon receipt of the corrected form because everything else looks in order.
Second.
There is a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? None opposed, the motion carries. So 11B is Brian Reisenauer, PsyD, EPPP, and licensure. And Dr. Medina, back to you again.
Thank you. Dr. Reisenauer received his doctoral degree from Midwestern University, an APA-accredited program. His APA-accredited internship was completed at Northeastern Oklahoma Psychology Internship Program. He completed 2,007 hours in his internship. He completed his postdoctoral experience at Comprehensive Psychological Services in Salt Lake City, Utah. He submitted a self-query. Dr. Reisenauer endorsed having a felony or misdemeanor in 2013 and completed 6 months of probation. It appears that Dr. Reisenauer fulfilled all the requirements from that incident. Everything else looks in order. As far as I'm concerned, the application looks to be in order. And so I move to approve this application.
Second.
There's a second. I'll give it to Dr. Seidman. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. 11C is Krista Perdue, CID.
Aye.
Waiver passed ACCC and not licensed independently. And Dr. Medina, the floor is yours.
Thank you again. Dr. Perdue graduated from Midwestern University in 2023, an IPR career program. She completed her 2,000-hour internship at Kaiser Permanente San Jose, an APIC member site, and a little over 1,500 hours of postdoctoral residency at McGady & Associates. Dr. Perdue received a passing score in her ACCC. Her self-query was submitted as well. Everything looks in order with this application, so I move to approve this application.
Second
by Dr. Caterino. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Aye. Thank you, Dr. Davey. None opposed. The motion carries. Okay, then let's go quickly to number 15, which is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding Behavior Analyst Certification Board call for 2025 Hemingway Award nominations. Ms. Pakkanen, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Behavior Analyst Certification Board, BACB, for a number of years has bestowed award recognizing a behavior analyst for distinguished contributions to the development of public policy initiatives related to behavior analysis and or to increase other work to increase the availability of behavior analytics services. The deadline for contributing a nomination is approaching October 15th. And so this agenda item is before the board in the event the board wishes to submit a nomination of a behavior analyst for consideration for the Hemingway Award.
Thank you, Ms. Pakkanen. Would any board member like to nominate a behavior analyst? I have somebody in mind, but I wanted to give first dibs to the professional members. Yes, Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to nominate Dr. Davey for his contributions to the profession in the state of Arizona and in this board. He has been here from the beginning. That behavior analysis was started to be regulated and licensable. So I would like to nominate him.
Second.
Thank you, Dr. Medina and Dr. Caterino. I think all of us feel the same way. Dr. Seidman, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I was just going to reiterate the same thing. Dr. Davies has done some really nice work in the field of behavior analysts, and I agree with all of my colleagues on the board here.
100%. Any further discussion? So there is a motion on the table. I understand we are sort of, you know, voluntelling Dr. Davey, but I think that's one of the things that he wouldn't mind. He has really been a valuable member of this board, and as everybody said, you know, he has been here from the very beginning of the BA profession being regulated in the state, and I look up to him a lot, respect him, and I'm fully in support of the motion. So all in favor of nominating Dr. Davey, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
I'll recuse from the vote. I can't. Thank you all.
All right, there is one recusal. And the motion passes. Congratulations, Dr. Davey. I know it's just a nomination, but you are the perfect person to receive the award if it were up to me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so after 15, we don't technically need Dr. Davey for other agenda items. I mean, obviously, you're welcome to stay as long as you're able. I know you have other time commitments, Dr. Davey, but let's move to 6D, which was pulled from the consent agenda. Dr. Catarino, pulled it, I'll lean on you to sort of start our discussion on the two times versus one and a half versus whatever the accommodation is.
But I just thought that, you know, we need some consistency and how do we make the determination? This applicant asked for two times. I have seen in the past other people ask for double time and we've only given one and a half. Like, is it just by, do we have a policy that if the doctor recommends it, we give whatever the doctor says, or do we, how do we make the decision if it's one and a half or double time? Just a little point.
That's a fair point. Maybe our board staff might have some insight on what has been our practice.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I was just about to suggest that, well, I could speak to this. What I feel more comfortable asking Ms. Folks to, because she has a longer historical perspective where these types of requests are concerned. So I'd like for her to sort of speak to, you know, what the board traditionally does when presented with a request, its options, you know, the precedent that's, you know, has been set over time. So she's the best resource to address this, I believe.
Mr. Chair, board members, this is Kathy. My understanding has been that the board relies heavily on the provider's recommendations for accommodations because they know the patient or the applicant best. I think the one time that Dr. Catarino was referencing, there were other factors that were going on with that one, and the board did make a different decision. But in every other time that I've seen a provider recommend double time, the board has relied on that and supported what the provider recommended. I hope that gives you the information you need. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Folks. That was helpful. Dr. Seidman.
Yeah, while I can understand the need for standardization, I do like the flexibility that the statute gives us to accommodate people as they request. And I believe double time is one of those availabilities. And I believe for Ms. Smith, Dr. Smith, their physician has requested double time specifically. So I'm in favor of giving double time for this particular person based on those issues.
Okay.
Is there any discussion or motion?
I just thought that, you know, we need a general policy, but I see maybe Dr. Simon is right. We need some flexibility to take things into consideration. I didn't want to leave things open where some people complain. Well, my doctor said I get double time, but you only gave me one and a half and other, you know, I just thought maybe we needed some guidelines, but that's.
I agree, Dr. Catarino. I mean, I recall there was a situation where we did discuss quite a bit, the request that had come in, and we had said time and a half based on the circumstances of that particular case. So I guess, I mean, my tendency is to, again, sort of look at a recommendation that has come from the physician or the psychologist and, you know, sort of take that because it has to be sort of a case-by-case evaluation rather than, you know, we only provide so much extra time because each person's situation and circumstances might be different. But that also means that, you know, if we do look at those applications carefully and if we see that it's not it's not a request that has come in for a good reason, then we, you know, we still retain the authority to sort of evaluate that request on a case-by-case basis for the merits. Dr. Seidman?
Thank you, Chairman Diner. I appreciate the conversation, and I'd like to make a motion to allow Dr. Smith for her extra time being double time, accommodation room, and frequent extended breaks.
Second by Dr. Stewart. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. All right, then let's go to number 14. If that's okay, Ms. Pakkanen. Okay. Discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding proposed amendment to the ASPPB bylaws and ASPPB response to the same. And Ms. Pakkanen, will you please provide a summary to the board?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So the timing of this matter appearing on this particular agenda is important because there this is the last opportunity that the board, final opportunity the board would have to consider this issue and provide direction to Arizona's delegate to the ASPPB annual meeting. So Dr. Stewart is our designated delegate for this purpose. And so it's imperative that when he is in the meeting and, you know, this proposal comes before the membership, that he be aware of, you know, what this jurisdiction position is. So just very succinctly, what I will report is that the Texas State Board of Examiners of Psychologists is proposing a bylaws amendment, the bylaws specifically of the ASPPB. And that content appears on page 3 of your memorandum. It follows the existing bylaws of ASPPB. So those are represented on page 2, and the proposed bylaws would insert new language in Article 4. It would create new subsections C and D. So the summary on page 3 is the representation, excuse me, of how it is that Texas is proposing the bylaws be amended, that is available for your review. Subsections, new subsections D and C and D, and that what that language would comprise. And then what follows that is the rationale and the justification that the Texas board is would like to accompany the proposed bylaw changes. And then beginning on page 6, there's a fairly extensive response from ASPPB that speaks to the board of directors' position on the proposed bylaw changes. So what it addresses, of course, would be sort of the totality of this issue, which consists of a lot of communications between the Texas Board and ASPPB and some other strategies in addition to the proposed bylaws change. But Texas has sought to advance its position in a variety of ways, and those are mentioned in the response. What the response also does is it summarizes what ASPPB has determined would be we'll call them unintended consequences or the implications of this type of a bylaws change should it be adopted by the membership. So just to take a step back, this is somewhat unusual or perhaps entirely unusual to ASPPB in its history. I think what they represented in the letter is there has really been no precedent or no previous attempts on the part of a member jurisdiction to seek a bylaws modification. I will tell you that my time with the Federation of State Boards of Physical Therapy, this was a more common occurrence, not frequent, but every, you know, maybe 5 to 8 years, some type of proposal would precipitate from a member board and be proposed to the membership for consideration. And it follows a very precisely outlined parliamentary procedure. And so ASPPB explains that, you know, this issue, you know, when it comes before the membership, it will be driven by a very formal process, and a parliamentarian presides over that process. So that's kind of, I think that's important to sort of have that that kind of context. There will be ample opportunity too at the meeting for discussions, both formal and informal, between the member jurisdictions, between the members and the ASPPB board and so forth. So Dr. Stewart and I have had a little bit of conversation around that. You know, he understands the expectations, you know, to be present for those scheduled discussions when they are to occur. So I will stop there unless anyone has any questions for me. I can't say that I'm particularly a subject matter expert where the actual content of the bylaws change is concerned, but maybe I can sort of illuminate a little better, you know, how it is that, you know, this proposal could be considered the debate that will ensue, and of course, you know, the vote that the membership will ultimately take. So do you have any questions for me before, you know, the board members take up the discussion or deliberation?
So the only question I have is each member state gets one vote. So even if there are like one or two, three delegates, they just have one vote per state.
That is correct. What I believe to be the case is that there needs to be a two-thirds majority of the membership to consider a proposed bylaws amendment. I believe that was what I had read in the bylaws previously. If that's an important question, I was just curious, you know, in my mind. But if the board would like me to go back and research that, I can do that quickly. But typically, and again, I'm extrapolating from FSBPT, there would need to be a certain threshold of jurisdictions who first agree to let the proposed bylaws amendment be considered by the delegate assembly. And then, assuming it is approved, then that it is considered. If the threshold vote is not met, then the proposal dies. So I'll take the board's direction if you're curious about, you know, what that requirement might be.
And just a point of clarification, so I see Dr. Mulott, who was a member of the board, is a member at large at ASPPB, and so she would not be a delegate of the board. Currently, it's only Dr. Stewart who is the delegate of this board.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. So she's her role will be at the meeting specific to this issue. This you know, anything that comes before the delegate assembly is purely as a board member of ASPPB. So that's correct.
Okay. Any more questions for Ms. Pakkinen? Okay, then let's go into our discussion of this item, and maybe Dr. Stewart can provide some insights. I have some views on this, but I don't want to color our discussion based solely on my views, obviously. So, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, our board postpone the requirement of having the EPPP2 in order to get licensure, simply because a lack of what we felt at the time was preparatory materials, that there's no study materials for our applicants to consistently go to. There's nothing proposed by the, or nothing in place by ASPBB for such preparation. When ASPBB presented to our board, the idea was proposed that independent vendors would be providing that type of preparatory materials, like what it is now for any test of challenge for credentialing in the United States. There are always private vendors that come forth and have study materials, as well as, you know, preparation weekends and things like that. And it was my understanding at the time that that's what ASPPB had envisioned for the EPPP2. So we postponed having that as a requirement until such time that that could be provided. I'll certainly be interested in the discussion. There's a discussion informational group Wednesday afternoon in Dallas at the beginning of the meeting, where this will be the rollout of the combined test. EPPP1 and 2 will be combined by ASPPB. And so I'd be interested to hear what materials would be geared specifically toward the skills level, which is EPPP2. I think that the AZPA has, in their governing council, has discussed this in terms of their membership of psychologists in the state of Arizona. I don't know that we've received anything from the governing council of ASPA or not at this time, but I would certainly welcome their input as well. My request to this board is to give me some direction in terms of what questions to ask, and maybe if there are voting preferences, let me know that, and I'd appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Any board member has any thoughts on the Texas proposal and, you know, your maybe personal views on what's happening with EPPP Part 2 and the sort of the meat of the proposal that's coming from Texas? So I guess I can... I have a few thoughts on this, and my insight kind of comes from you know, the discussions that occurred at this board, you know, I don't know how many years ago, maybe like 3 years ago, when we were discussing EPPP Part 2, as Dr. Stewart had summarized. You know, we looked very carefully at the at, you know, how ASPPB was sort of, at least in the view of a majority of the board at the time, sort of, you know, shoving Part 2 down our throats. So it was very much sort of viewed as a private association coming in and dictating policy at the state level. And you know, at the same time, they did not have materials that would aid the students in having good outcomes at the when they do choose to take the EPPP Part 2 test. And the other consideration at the time was, you know, so many years ago, when all of these psychology boards were set up, the skills component was sort of built into the statutes by requiring as a condition of licensure, you know, that they do internships, they do postdocs. So that's how the board, as a licensing institution at the state level, gets some degree of assurance that the applicant entering the profession has the necessary skills to practice professionally, to practice ethically, and so forth. So given the fact that our statutes have sort of a awareness that, you know, that there is some skills component involved in licensure, the way that the legislature chose to address that issue was to have, you know, as a condition of licensure, some of these postdoc, internship, et cetera, requirements. So it seems like after Arizona, well, I should back up. So Arizona, I think, was one of the early adopters of ERPP Part 2, and we had a requirement that people, applicants, take ERPP Part 2 for a few years. So Arizona, I think, was also an early rejecter of ERPP Part 2, and I am fully aware of, you know, the sort of relationship that was affected between this board and ASPPB when we decided not to require applicants in Arizona to take ERPP Part 2. I'm fully aware of sort of the impact of that. But I think, you know, given our board's history in the state of Arizona, that was the right decision at the time. And I personally continue to believe that it's still the right decision to not require ERPP Part 2, because the skills component is adequately addressed by our statutory requirement of, you know, postdoc and all of the job experience requirements. So I think what's happening now is that ASPPB sees sort of the writing on the wall that, you know, boards like Arizona, we are, again, held to our statutory requirements. We are rejecting sort of the ASPPB's attempt to require ERPP Part 2 across the board. So then ASPPB comes and says, okay, you know, now it's just one exam, which has several components, a knowledge component and a skills component. So ERPP Part 2 and Part 1 is just one exam. So it's just them saying, oh, you know, we just change the label that we attach to the exam. It's just one exam. And now it has a skills component. And we still have maybe one practice exam on the website, nothing else, and no real study materials are provided to the students who are taking these exams. So in response to that, then Texas comes in and says, no, actually, you can't force states to adopt ERPP Part 2 in this sort of a sneaky way. So we are requiring you to, so we are, you know, proposing an amendment to the bylaws of ASPPB and saying that, you know, you can't force any states to do anything, because ultimately we as states have, you know, our policymaking branch, the legislature, decide these issues for us, and they have decided these issues for us. And we have to follow our, you know, the representatives of our people in the state on this, and not some private association's dictates or mandates. So that's, I think, how I'm seeing this is, you know, when states started rejecting ERPP Part 2, ASPPB sort of had a clever idea of, no, we can still make you have ERPP Part 2. And then states like Texas are pushing back on that. So my personal view seems to be that, you know, are the delegate of this board, at least, again, in my personal view, I don't speak for everybody. I just get one vote on this board. But my view is that our delegate should support the Texas proposal to amend the bylaws of ASPPB. I'll stop there, and obviously I'm interested in everyone's views on this as well. Ms. Pakkanen.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would be remiss if I didn't call to the board's attention what I believe is the mandate to be in the state of Arizona, and I look to Ms. Galvin for you know, her perspective as well. It is the statute 32-2072 examinations. Semicolon exemptions at subsection A, the language states an applicant for licensure must pass the examination for professional practice in psychology, which is the national examination established by the Association of State and Provincial Psychology Boards.
Ms. Galvin, any thoughts on the question?
When the part two of the EPPP was being developed and the boards were being informed of its eventual, you know, application requirement, the board had a discussion about whether their statutes would need to be amended to account for part two of the EPPP. And at that time, and it still is, my reading of the statute, as Heidi just pointed out, would encompass part two of the, you know, original EPPP examination. So our statutes does require an applicant to pass that national exam, and that national exam will eventually comprise of two parts. So based on our exam, based upon our statute, we will have to implement that once the EPPP2 becomes permanent and required by all jurisdictions.
Any more discussion items? So I think to that issue, Ms. Packen and Ms. Galvin, what's happening is the ASPPB is saying, well, it's just one exam because of, you know, maybe other states have statutes like Arizona's, where it's the national exam. So they're sort of trying to make this one big exam that has both the knowledge component and the skills component. But if Texas's proposal is, so if Texas's proposal becomes part of the ASPPB bylaws, then essentially, you know, you ASPPB will not be in the position to sort of have this, you know, cutesy argument, oh, you know, it was always ever this one national exam. Was just called part one, part two, and now it's just the national exam. So I think that's what the proposal is attempting to do, is to say, no, actually, you know, the states, the statutory requirements are what they are still for licensure. I mean, you still need to have a knowledge component, and you can't require us to have this other component just because we are taking the EPPP part one knowledge component from ASPPB. So there's definitely something to be said about, you know, ASPPB trying, reading the same statutes that we are, and then still trying to somehow sneak in EPPP Part 2 via a different way. And then, you know, that's the kind of mandate or coercion based on the statutory schemes that I see ASPPB coming in and sort of, and I think, I mean, I wouldn't go as far as to say that that's a affront to sort of state sovereignty for many states, but it sort of is, you know, it's ASPPB coming in and saying, oh, you know, we can make a sneaky argument based on the statutes that all of these legislatures have passed across the 50 states. And, you know, if we had the mandate from the legislature and the governor, that would be one thing. But if the mandate is coming from a private association, then I personally have problems with that. Dr. Katerina.
You know, I'm wondering if they take out the requirement for this, even part one, I mean, could this be that we take out part one and then any state could make up their own, you know, 5-question true and false exam, and then we would have a, you know, degrading of the skills of the psychologists. And I'm just wondering if this leaves it open to each state making up their own little exam. So I think there should be some kind of guideline. And then also second point is, you know, would we have to change a statute, or how would this work, since the statute does say the national exam is required? Just a thought.
Thank you, Dr. Katerina. Ms. Pakkanen?
Just to, I think, speak a little bit to what Dr. Katerina was. Her comments potentially open up the door, I think, to this line of discussion, or this set of questions, you know, relative to what about jurisdictions developing their own examinations if they find, you know, for whatever reason that, and they do have the authority to do so in statute, that they have, the mandate is not the EPPP, that state has the latitude to, you know, adopt a different assessment, including one that they develop, maintain, and administer, and so forth. I don't think it would come as a surprise to this board for me to tell you that, it would take years, and I literally mean years, to develop what would be a psychometrically sound, valid, and defensible examination. It would have to start with a job task analysis. There would have to be a blueprint or a content outline developed. There would need to be a robust set of items to be written and reviewed and approved and validated and tested, and it would cost millions of dollars even before the sweep that we experienced of the Psychology Board's fund. I think the proportionate share to psychology, you know, I'm trying to remember the exact value. I may be confusing it with the BA funds. At any rate, the total of $1.4 million, which was swept from the agency fund, wouldn't have even scratched the surface. So even if we had those dollars in our account and a big uncertainty, even if we could convince the legislature that you know, we were prepared to use those dollars to develop our own assessment for entry into the profession, it would be so inadequate as to, you know, be you know, an entirely pointless exercise. So that being said, you know, other states may have the resources to develop what is, you know, their own independent assessment. That, of course, is a state-by-state decision, and, you know, that would be something that states would turn to, you know, their statutory authority and other considerations, too, to, you know, ascertain, can they move forward? Should they? Are they able to, and so forth? That's a big consideration, and you know, some states are having those conversations. You know, acknowledging that we couldn't do that, the other jurisdictions, you know, if they wish to stay, you know, or conform or shift a pivot to, you know, the new reality as is stated now on January 1, 2026, the examination tests two domains, knowledge and skills, in a single examination, then what will ensue is that the jurisdictions who follow that model, there will be more mobility of applicants of psychologists between those jurisdictions. So if any jurisdiction were to elect to deviate, you know, away from this model, then what it would do is it would put future psychologists, it would force them to evaluate, do I take the test that Texas hypothetically self-develops, but I also want some mobility in my career. I may want to be in SciPact to have their authorization. I may want to hold two licenses, you know, in two different jurisdictions for some reason. I may want to move with my family to another jurisdiction, in which case I may be faced with the requirement to take the ECCC. And if I didn't do that at the time that I graduated or early career, then I lack the qualifications to, you know, to package up, you know, my skills and bring them elsewhere. So that is a factor that I think will be a lot of the conversation at this meeting. That's just something that I've been thinking about. And I will say that one of the things that I found to be interesting in the ASPPB response was just, you know, how, again, the, you know, the implications of this kind of a bylaws change, what might it mean, you know, to the ECCC and its validity in general? I have seen instances where such a dynamic, you know, shift in examination, development, and administration, what it compels the organization who sponsors it to do is to pull the examination from availability for a period of time while the organization evaluates how to move forward in such a way that the exam still is valid and defensible. So there is a little bit of concern that one jurisdiction electing to, take the exit ramp away from the modified examination and, you know, forge their own solution potentially. That's a jurisdiction by jurisdiction association. But what do we want to avoid? A situation where supporting jurisdictions are faced with inaccessibility to the examination for a period of time. So I think those issues will be discussed more at the meeting. And I don't feel that I'm certainly not a subject matter expert to them, but those were kinds of the comments that I didn't necessarily expect to see, but I took note of those in the ASPPB response.
Thank you, Ms. Pakkinen. Dr. Catarino?
Yes, no, I definitely, you're correct that to develop an appropriate and statistically valid and reliable test, it would take a great deal of money. My concern was that some states, would develop an inferior test, and then the person would say, I'm licensed here and I want to transfer to another state, and then we don't know the quality of that person's knowledge if they did not take an appropriate test. So, because we've had states where they only require a master's to be a psychologist, I think at one point West Virginia. I'm in favor of having one test that the states could, I'm not sure about part two yet, but that states could opt out, could not really opt out and make up their own tests. And I thought they may just be discussing part two here in Texas, but I'm afraid that a state could interpret that, and then people could get in without tests or without qualified tests and then transfer to Arizona and affect our public. So that was my thought.
Thank you, Dr. Catarino. Dr. Stewart?
Thank you, Mr. Dunner. I do not disagree that if Arizona deviates and does not require the ECCC or let's say ASPBB was willing to separate their two parts of the same test, if ASPBB was willing to consider that first part, the traditional ECCC 1, and the second part, the skills, is ECCC 2. For portability in SciPac, you almost have to, well, ASPPB owns SciPac. And so in order to play with their basketball on their court, you have to pay the entry fee. And that is by taking the exams. I absolutely agree with Mr. Dinar. ASPPB went about this in a disingenuous fashion. I think Mr. Dinar used the term sneaky, and I'm hesitant to say that, but in this case, I think it's applicable. It was underhanded, I think, for them to say, oh, it's the same test, we've just revised it. And now it happens to be two parts, and you can take it over different days and things like that. Their approach is disingenuous, and that just irritates me beyond belief. In terms of I understand that for Arizona to develop a psychometric instrument for skills would be prohibitive in terms of expenses. Of course, I was licensed. My license number is 000656. And so I remember the days when psychologists sat before the board for an interview as a part of the requirement. And there's absolutely nothing, if ASPPB would consent, or if there's a mechanism by which ECCC, the first part, could be taken, and then for for the second part of the same test not be taken, and then the board, the application review committee, maybe to schedule interviews. That would certainly meet the statutory requirement in my reading of it in Arizona. I'm not an attorney. I don't pretend to be. But it's just the process in which ASPPB went about this. It just sticks in my craw. Thank you, Mr. Dunner.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Any discussion or motion? I think on an issue like this, disagreement is to be expected and is to be welcomed, because you know I think the deliberations of the board become sharper because of the differences in our views and the disagreement. So I do commend everybody for feeling that they can openly voice their disagreements and opinions on this. I don't by any means want to curtail any discussion that's happening, but we are sort of in a position where we need to provide some direction. Yes, yes or no? I mean, those are the two, that's the fork in the road to the delegate of this board, because the meeting at which ASPPB is going to consider this is, I believe, coming up soon, and we don't have another meeting to continue the discussion of this particular issue. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Dinar. Yes, in spite of my personal feelings, I will vote and support the wishes of this board as a single delegate. And I think the discussion part will come up Wednesday, October 30th at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Texas local time. And I will be supporting whatever this board directs me to, whatever direction you want me to go. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Medina?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to share that, you know, I agree with your take, and I see where you're coming from and with your statements about the test part two, how it was introduced, how then it was, you know, sort of became part of this test. At the same time, I think that not agreeing with what ASBPB is saying would lead to a fragmentation of our profession. We have fought very, very, very hard for many, many, many years to get some level of, you know, whether it's reciprocity, being able to operate in other states, be recognized as a, you know, in our profession. And I do view the national examination as a way to do that. You know, medical boards, it's not just one exam, right? It's several exams over the course of the career. In my opinion, I view the questions in part two more relevant to the practice of psychology than even part one, because part one is heavy on memory. And part two is application to my work with the public. And so I don't see it as irrelevant to our profession. I do believe that it has a place. When it was removed as part of our licensing requirement, it was due to the lack of study materials and the opportunity to give our applicants that opportunity to prepare for it. It wasn't necessarily because it was a bad test or it didn't ask pertinent questions. It was a matter of, that's okay, this test is out, but you're not giving our applicants a fair chance at passing it if there aren't any significant study materials. And that was the essence of the reason why it was removed at that time, and that it would come down the line. We knew that at that point, and that at that point there would be more study materials. I believe there are a few more things available to study for it. I haven't done a deep dive to look at what it is, but I would be against any measure that would lead to the fragmentation of our profession, even if it is in another state. So I do agree with what ASBPB is suggesting.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. That actually reminds me of, we did the jurisprudence tool or the jurisprudence continuing education, which was a tool that was developed, you know, by the board. So we spent some money on it. And at the time, we wanted that to be a requirement, not of licensure, but of continuing to remain licensed. So we wanted to have a rule change, which failed for other reasons at the with the Governor's Regulatory Review Council. So now it's an option for Arizona licensed psychologists to take the jurisprudence tool. And, you know, in terms of sort of, you know, what's practical and what's very beneficial to practice in the state, I think it was a unanimous decision at the time of the board that we need to have people understand the sort of unique statutory scheme that we have in Arizona. Not every state has the same statutory scheme. So it's very important for people to understand the jurisprudence in Arizona to be successful, because we're, as a board, we're seeing sort of many complaints, many issues in cases where they could have been very easily addressed if only the psychologists knew what our unique quirk in Arizona is. So I think, I mean, in terms of sort of, I understand sort of the fragmentation of the profession, the portability of licenses across state lines. But that has, I think, always been the case. You're always going to have some unique circumstances in the statutory scheme of each state that you would, you know, any entering applicant slash psychologist would have to comes in with the understanding that there are, that each state has a unique structure, each state has a unique set of statutes and rules that they have to follow. So I don't see it so much as a, I mean, I understand that's an issue, but I don't see that that issue is in any way, the needle on that issue is changed because of the Texas proposal. I think, you know, we would still continue to have a national exam that is administered by ASPPB, you know, the EPPP, whatever they call it. And I think we will continue to have a knowledge component in our statutes, just as in, I hope, in the statutes of every other state, right? I mean, that's the basic thing, education, knowledge. And then the other component, I think, we'll never be in a situation where we completely disregard skills of an applicant for psychology. It's just that, you know, each state has come up with a different solution through their legislatures. The, you know, some states have said, okay, you know, here are the sort of internship postdoc requirements. And I think that has pretty much standardized, again, as Dr. Medina was saying, maybe, you know, the profession has worked hard on getting that sort of on-the-job experience put into the statutes as a condition of licensure. So I don't think that's changing anytime soon. The question is that skills component going to be tested, or is that skills component going to be developed through that on-the-job practical training, which may be a better approximation of, you know, what kind of tools and skills a psychologist needs than, you know, maybe like a 20-question multiple choice exam. And also want, in terms of like my perspective on things, I think there are many professions, not just psychology, that, you know, struggle with portability and, you know, crossing across state lines. And that's why we have SCIPAC. That's why we have some kind of a standardized test. And that's why we have maybe recognition, statutory recognition of the fact that each state is going to have some different ways of addressing the same issue. So we're going to sort of give full faith and credit to the decisions of that state. So let's imagine a state that, you know, develops its own test, knowledge test or a skills test. Then every other state would have to decide, well, you know, that state made a decision, you know, maybe their legislature made a decision, maybe their psychology board made a decision, and we just have to give full faith and credit to the decision of that state. And if that licensee wants to get licensed in Arizona, we look at, you know, maybe our universal licensure law. Maybe we look to see if our state's requirements for licensure have been met. And if the answer is, well, really, that that test that this one state developed is not up to the mark, then we just say, well, you can't come under universal licensure. You need to get independently tested at the national level. So we as a state still have the ability to require somebody to take a national examination. And then it's up to the individual if they want to get licensed here or not. You know, they are in charge of their own professional career trajectory and where they live in the United States and all of that. So I would trust, or rather have confidence that, you know, each state is looking at this issue and thinking about the same issues perhaps and arriving at different answers. But I wouldn't necessarily want to prevent any state from arriving at a solution that is not the ASPPB solution. So, you know, I'm in support of sort of letting states have the choice that they do have based on their statutory schemes. I've said enough. I stopped there. I apologize for rambling. Dr. Flint.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, I think I've been pretty vocal even before my board membership about some of the challenges of the part two. I'm concerned about the extra cost for students, the extra time to licensure. I also appreciate highly Dr. Medina's comments about the possibility of fragmenting kind of some of the cores of psychology. But I also want us to just keep in mind that relying solely on a sign off of skills from an internship or postdoc does not, in my mind, always necessarily equate competence. We have lots of programs who don't want to go necessarily the extra mile to remediate individuals who are having skills deficits. I'm just going to say it bluntly. And those people get the same license that all of us sitting on this board have. And so relying solely on that also seems problematic in some ways. Now we might view it as it catches most people, so we have to do something and be good with something. That could be the bar that we outside for sure. But I don't want us to get under this false sense of security that a sign off on an internship completion equates to protecting the public. Because I've been in academia now going on a couple decades, and I've seen example after example where I'm like, where was the gatekeeping process? So there's my and I realize I'm not giving a solid commitment either way. This is a complicated issue. And there was my and. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Flynn. Dr. Simon.
Thank you, Chairman Diner. Here's another and. To piggyback on the and just given, in our jurisdiction, remember that we allow applicants who have come from unaccredited programs, both academic and otherwise, so pre-doctoral, pre-internship, and postdoctoral. And that doesn't sit well in terms of a measure of competency when there's no regulatory body over those placements. And those people, we assume, are competent to practice at the doctoral level and independently. The ECPP Part 2, it doesn't feel good that we're being told that we have to have our applicants take that. And, you know, I was thinking earlier about in most cases, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. However, we need to be careful and really measure competency. And we know other professions are in a competency-based model of licensure. And I think we really need to pay attention to this idea of what is competency and how do we measure it? How do we ensure to the public that we're protecting them? Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman. Any discussion or motion? Dr. Medina.
I would like to make a motion. I move to approve the proposed bylaws language from ASBPB.
A second.
Point of clarification.
Yeah.
The proposed bylaws change is coming from the state of Texas, from their Omnibus Behavior Health Board. ASPPB is taking the stance that no change be made. And so they want to deliver a null vote in the business meeting for ASPPB. So we're not supporting the bylaws. We're supporting ASPPB's position to deny the change in bylaws as put forth by the state of Texas. Thank you.
So Dr. Medina,
that is the motion. I'm sorry, yes.
So could you please clarify your motion? Are you supporting the amendment to the bylaws offered by Texas?
No.
Okay.
So you support ASPPB's position to not accept that those proposed bylaws changes.
So your position would be to oppose the amendments offered by Texas?
Correct. Thank you. My apologies.
I did not understand that clearly. I second that. I understand.
Yeah, that's an important clarification for the motion on the table. Ms. Pakkinen.
Mr. Chair, may I just make an advisory comment to the board after this vote, please?
Sure, yeah.
And okay. We have a roll call. And did we get a second?
Yes, Dr. Katerina was the second.
So to be clear, the motion is to oppose the amendment to the bylaws offered by Texas.
Correct.
Ms. Poe, will you call the... Well, actually, let me see if there is any further discussion. Dr. Flint.
Just a point of clarification, please. If we put this motion approval forward, is there any other way to do this, considering that the conversation hasn't happened on both sides at this event? It feels to me premature before hearing what the outcome of that is. But I might be just misunderstanding the process.
Ms. Pakkinen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to try to address your question, Dr. Flint. So Dr. Stewart has mentioned in a couple of instances an information session to be held on Wednesday. I believe that's October 30th. And then the delegates will assemble, I believe it to be on Friday. So that, of course, will be, the robust discussion where delegates consider whether to even introduce the amendment, the proposed amendment. I did confirm that's a 2/3 vote threshold to meet. So it's kind of a high bar for, 2/3 of the jurisdictions to even agree to hear this. But then there would be if the delegates agree, the motion is to be considered, the proposed bylaws changes to be considered, then the discussion occurs. So, and maybe Dr. Flynn, it feels a little uncomfortable that, we're sending a sole representative, to really go to a meeting and, learn a whole lot more potentially than what you all know right now. But that's typical, common, and very much, a reflection of this process. And while I'm here, Mr. Chair, I hope it's okay to say, as I think about this, I really think there are two votes here, and I don't think it matters what order you take them in necessarily, but I think you need two motions for direction to Dr. Stewart. One would be the one that's on the table, and then the other motion would be whether to even again agree to comprise the 2/3 majority to have the bylaws proposed change introduced. So that I think both things need to happen. If that makes sense.
So could you clarify, Ms. Pakkinen, what the second part, because that's not clear to me.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. So Dr. Stewart needs to know how to represent Arizona when the question is presented to the delegates. Do you want this motion for the proposed bylaws changes to be formally brought before the body, brought before the delegates? So 2/3 would need to approve even hearing the proposed bylaws change. If that vote threshold isn't met, it's never introduced, it dies. So I'm sure that what ASPPB's parliamentarian will present is membership, delegates, do you want to have this formally proposed, yes or no? And then the vote is tallied. If it's a yes, then the proposed bylaws amendment is considered. If it's a no, it dies and they move on to the next order of business.
Yeah, that's helpful, actually. So Dr. Medina, I think the first motion should be whether we authorize our delegate to vote yes to have a discussion at ASPPB about this issue. That's the first thing that needs to happen. And then the second thing that needs to happen is if at that point the delegates discuss the pros and cons of Texas's proposal and then actually put Texas's proposal up for vote, then we need a second motion to give our delegate the authority to vote whichever way the board chooses on that second motion. So I think, Dr. Medina, your motion related to that second aspect, not the first aspect, if I'm correct.
Yes, that is correct.
So because we already have one motion on the floor and it's been seconded, I'm hearing from the chair that you would prefer the board vote first on whether to instruct Dr. Stewart to entertain the discussion at the meeting should come first. Is that correct?
Correct.
Then Dr. Medina and Dr. Katarina should withdraw their first and second.
If they so choose.
If they so they, I'm sorry. So they, the motion, I'm sorry. I did something and.
Zoom does it. It's AI.
No, that's my fault, Mr. Chair, Dr. Medina. It only occurred to me as the motion, you know, sort of as it was happening, I thought, really, there's two. I just realized there needs to be two motions to give the right direction to Dr. Stewart. So if there are, I know there to be jurisdictions who will send their delegate and the direction is vote no on the consideration of the proposed amendment, end of discussion. So this board needs to decide, do you want to take that position or the opposite position is, sure, let's put it before the delegates, you know, for a discussion. So, you know, I think Mr. Chair, I'll look at Jean, but Dr. Medina, she maybe could modify her her motion, or I think what Ms. Galvin was saying, maybe Dr. Medina's motion needs to be the second one. And I apologize that it wasn't, I needed some time to sort of, you know, come to this realization that there's a preliminary step before the more impactful substantive vote, if you will.
Okay. So we can either consider them together in one motion or separate in two separate motions. Yes. So I will amend my motion and I move that we vote no on the consideration of the amendment because I think that is congruent with then the second part of the motion, which is voting no to not what I said first. I'm sorry. I'm getting confused.
But I think the first part of your motion is to instruct Dr. Stewart to vote no when asked whether to bring the amendments to discussion before the body.
Yes. And the second part is, yes.
Let's do one at a time so we're clear. So that would be the first motion.
Is there a second? Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Chairman Diner. I want to bring up, what would the downside be of getting more information from the Texas folks? I was going to actually make a motion to allow that, to have Dr. Stewart allow him to say yes, at least for us to hear more information from their folks.
Thank you, Dr. Seidman. Yeah, I was with you on, I'm with you on that. But there's a motion. Is there a second for purposes of discussion so we can have that discussion, Dr. Seidman?
I didn't want to second that because I want to hear more information too.
Yeah, okay. Well then, Dr. Medina, would you consider amending or withdrawing your motion?
I will amend my motion to agree to the consideration of the amendment.
I second that.
Okay, that's just part one. Like, we'll do part two separately. Yeah.
Thanks, Dr. Medina.
So, Ms. Pakkanen.
Thank you. Yes. So, if the membership approves the introduction, if the threshold is met for the bylaws introduction to be met, I think I'm answering your question, Dr. Seidman. So the parliamentarian would preside over how to enable Texas, you know, to present and, you know, justify what it is that they're proposing in terms of the bylaws change. And there would likely be then, you know, an opportunity for ASPPB to also speak to it. So it's going to be guided by, you know, the rules of procedure that are adopted.
So do we have to vote on the second right now? Would all of that happen there? Oh.
Yeah, well, that's where I was going with that is, you know, I am very interested in having ASPPB delegates have a full discussion, pros and cons. And I think ideally what should happen is the delegates will learn a lot of information based on that discussion. Ideally, what I would want to see is that delegate then brings that information back to us. And then we, based on that new information, that new learning curve, we can then authorize the delegate as to whether, as a board, we support or oppose Texas's proposal. But failing that, maybe there is like an interim step where if when the parliamentarian, let's say, takes the procedural reins of this whole issue in their hand, is there a way to allow the delegates to come back with the newly learned information to their respective boards, have that discussion at the board level, and then go back at a future time to actually vote on the Texas proposal? Dr. Stewart.
Yeah, that would be ideal. However, the way the agenda reads for the meeting, we're having an informational session put on by ASPPB on Wednesday afternoon, October 30th. And then the voting, there's two-thirds to support it, and it goes to the floor as an amendment to be considered, then that takes place Friday morning. So there's no opportunity unless there would be a committee or an ad hoc committee of this board that Heidi and myself could contact on Wednesday late afternoon or Thursday morning to discuss what was presented during the informational session. And then if it does go to the floor to be voted on, that's going to happen in real time on Friday, November 1st. And so there won't be an availability of the board, I'm afraid, to meet and let us discuss that. So again, an ad hoc committee that maybe could be convened by telephone or video Thursday morning might offer some support for resolution.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. And you know, what that tells me is ASPPB is creating procedural rules that it hopes will favor ASPPB. That just makes me much more disappointed in ASPPB's timeline with all of this. There is a motion and second on the table. Ms. Pakkanen?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So I'm turning back to ASPPB's bylaws, which of course are, that's their governing document. And I believe that the way they are constructed, so much the way, you know, a legislative session operates, an idea is introduced and it has, you know, only so much time and opportunity to advance and either be approved or not be approved. So, you know, in terms of this cycle, if you will, for the, you know, the bylaws amendment to be considered, any jurisdiction any member can bring a bylaws proposed change. In this case, Texas did, and Texas met the July 29th, I think it was, agenda. It was a late date in July at any rate. They submitted before that deadline. And so the proposed amendment, then again, step one, members, do two-thirds of you agree to hear and consider this amendment, yes or no? If yes, then the next procedural threshold is the debate and the parliamentarian, you know, presiding over the debate and outlining how that is to take place. So that process ensues and a vote is taken. So two-thirds of the membership, if they said yes, let's consider the amendment, and that debate occurs, then three-quarters must approve the amendment in order for it to pass. If the proposed amendment dies, it would have another opportunity, it or some other variation or iteration or something completely different that can then be introduced in the next bylaws consideration cycle, which would be in 2025.
Dr. Flint?
As you describe the process, and I know we can't change another organization's process, I understand that. And this is yet another example of, in less than 24 hours, decisions will be made without proper input that affect every future licensee in the entire nation. And I think that is irresponsible. I just want that on the record.
Thank you, Dr. Flint. Okay, so the motion on the table is to allow discussion to happen at ASPPB on this issue. Roll call, please, Ms. Poe.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinart?
Yes.
Dr. Medina?
Yes.
Dr. Stewart?
I don't know if I should recuse myself or not. I
no need to.
Okay, I vote yes.
Thank you. Dr. Catarino?
Yes.
Dr. Flint?
Yes.
Dr. Seidman?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. So then the next thing would be, so here's what I'm thinking. So, you know, to Dr. Flint's comment, we can't force the organization to change their procedures. Sure, I mean, 100% agree. But if the delegates would consider a motion at that time in that 24-hour period to postpone a vote on the Texas proposal so that the delegates can go back to their respective boards, share information, and then come back with more instruction from the board, then assuming that if, how do we instruct our delegate on the question of postponing the vote at ASPPB on the Texas issue? That, so I think there's that interim step before we get to the whether we support or oppose the Texas motion, but just wanted to throw it out there to see people's reactions to it. Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel that it would... we wouldn't have all the information to vote, because then I understand their bylaws, but if we're voting yes. Okay, let's hear the arguments. They hear the arguments, but we're giving Dr. Stewart direction on how to vote when we have not heard, you know, both sides. I just don't see how that is possible unless we give Dr. Stewart the space to make a decision in name of the board. I just wanted that on the record. I just think it's very difficult to go one way or the other without hearing the arguments.
Thank you. Ms. Paikkanen?
Mr. Chair, if the board is unable to take a position on this, you know, today, and give Dr. Stewart the question, you know, truly is, if the required threshold is met, the proposed bylaws amendment comes before the delegate assembly, Dr. Stewart needs to be clear on which way to vote, yes or no. But there is an alternative that he could register, which is to abstain. It doesn't, I think, address some of the concerns that I'm articulating, but an abstention, you know, reflects many things, which, you know, an abstention represents, it's not a yes or a no. But I think that what, I think that the, no, never mind. I think I'll stop there. So I see this as, you know, Dr. Stewart has three choices and the board needs to give him the direction, yes, no, or abstain. I think it's just that straightforward.
Dr. Caterina?
I know this is just a direct opposite to Ms. Packerman, but could we make a motion to instruct Dr. Stewart that he ask for a motion to not take a vote that day, but to postpone it to after he's been able to consult at the next board meeting with Arizona board members, to just make that motion. They can still reject it, but if he would be comfortable with that.
You know, this actually reminds me of the 13 colonies that met to declare independence of the United States. And New York's delegates did not have a direction from New York State, so they voted present, but ultimately they changed their vote to yes on declaring independence. That history perhaps is instructive here. But Dr. Stewart,
from New York, you want to bring that
up? I mean, it was the unanimous decision of the 13 colonies to declare independence, and that's how we have the US of A. I think we are trying to thread a needle when the situation is necessarily dynamic. I tend to believe that, you know, the discussion is definitely helpful, and that's what our previous vote was. But in terms of what this board needs to instruct our delegate at this time, we have a, you know, fully deliberated, discussed, and presented arguments from both sides, from Texas and from ASPPB, in writing in front of us. And based on that information, we are voting to instruct our delegate. New information might come up. Maybe, you know, that newly discussed information might lead the delegates naturally to vote on postponement. If not, then the board's instruction would still be based on the information as it currently exists in front of us in writing. So that's where I'm sort of leaning, to just simplify things and, you know, give some clear direction to Dr. Stewart, as opposed to saying, okay, just vote abstain or vote present. So I guess I'll make a motion. Let's see what happens. I'll make a motion to instruct Dr. Stewart, as the delegate of the board, to make a vote at ASPPB to delay or postpone a vote on Texas's proposal That's my motion.
I second that.
Dr. Medina.
What if that's not an option?
Then
how
the third
should
vote.
Vote?
You could make the motion.
That will be the third. That will be a third motion.
Oh, now we're okay. Got it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Got it. I believe Dr. Caterino's second.
Do we want to provide guidance to him for a period of, you know, what, 60 days to allow, you know, delegates to go back to their boards and just so it's not, you know, open-ended and...
Right. I think it's enough time so that there is at least one meeting that each state has, right? Board meeting. And some states don't have monthly meetings. Some states have six meetings a year, et cetera. So considering all of that, I would leave it to the delegates to understand what their individual states' dynamics are. But the time frame is at least one intervening state board meeting to have occurred before ASPPP takes a vote. Is that enough or sufficiently concrete and not open-ended? Ms. Pakkanen.
Again, I'm looking at the bylaws of ASPPB, and what I see is that the bylaws may be amended only at a face-to-face, annual, or special meeting of the association at which a quorum is present. So I think, I mean, I'm not telling you to, you know, try an attempt to curtail or compel the board, you know, in any particular way on the motion on the table, but just for discussion purposes and awareness purposes, there is, again, a very specifically outlined, you know, procedure that authorizes when and how bylaws amendments are to be considered. So just, you know, vote, but you know, with the understanding there may or may not be a an opportunity before the next face-to-face annual meeting. There may or may not be a special meeting which a quorum is present. Those are unknowns.
Understood. Thank you. Okay, so there's a motion and second. Any further discussion? Okay, roll call, Ms. Poe.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Medina?
Yes.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
Dr. Caterino?
Yes.
Dr. Flint?
Yes.
Dr. Seidman?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. So now the third motion, which I think Dr. Medina was the motion that you initially wanted to make. Sorry, it took us time to get there, but we are there now.
It's okay. Based on the information we have today at this meeting, if what was proposed in the previous motion is not an option, then I move to not accept the proposed amendments that Texas is bringing to the table at the meeting.
Second.
Okay, there's a motion and a second. Any discussion? I think we have discussed this. That's how we started. Ms. Poe, roll call, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dinar.
No, I would be in support of adopting Texas's proposed amendments to the bylaws.
Dr. Medina?
Yes.
Dr. Stewart?
Yes.
Dr. Caterino?
Yes.
Dr. Flint?
No.
Dr. Seidman?
Yes.
We have a vote of 4 yeses, 2 noes. Motion carries.
Thank you. All right, Dr. Stewart, you have your instructions.
If I may have you memorialize this in writing for me, I would appreciate it. where I can make sure I live up to the letter and spirit of the vote.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Stewart, yes, of course, I will be there to make sure that, you know, what the board has provided in terms of, you know, its direction is clearly articulated. You have that with you. I may or may not be allowed to sit in the assembly with you as a non-voting member, as, you know, simply just, you know, another representative of the jurisdiction. So I hope if that's allowed that, you know, I can be right there at your side if you need any help.
And bring your stun gun.
Thank you. And thank you, board members, for a robust discussion. I really appreciated all of the thoughts and discussion that occurred. Okay, it's 10:14, and I know we have a cutoff at 11:30, but I think a comfort break is needed at this point. Let's make it a short one. Come back at 10:20 a.m.
Sure.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we'll go to number 9 and then number 8 was.
Okay. Thank you. I'm not seeing Dr. Seidman. We don't have a quorum without him, correct?
Correct.
All right, it is 10:21 and we are back in open session. We're going to number 9, which is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendation from the Committee on Behavior Analysts to dismiss complaint number 24-28 against Ashley Horton, MS. Dr. Stenhoff was the lead on this complaint, but Ms. Michelson will be providing us a overview. Ms. Michelson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, this complaint was reviewed by the committee last Friday. It was a joint complaint, so I'll be providing an overview of that joint complaint and then incorporating some of Dr. Stenhoff's comments as he provided me with some information to share with the board today. Complainant MD is the Senior Program Development Manager for the Department of Economic Security's Division of Developmental Disabilities. She is a licensed behavior analyst in Arizona. She filed a complaint against Ashley Horton, who was issued her behavior analyst license by the board in 2017, and filed against two other individuals, an applicant for licensure and a BCBA from another state who's not licensed in Arizona. The complaint contains allegations of fraudulent billing and unlicensed practice occurring at an agency that provides behavior analytic services called Swan Therapy Group. This company was established in 2023 and has multiple clinic locations throughout the Valley. These three respondents who are the subject of the complaint have worked for the agency in various roles. Currently, our pending applicant for licensure is the only respondent still working for that agency. Specifically, Ms. Horton worked for Swan Therapy for approximately 5 months in 2023. Her position was listed as assessment BCBA. Dr. Stenhoff noted that the CBA found through the adjudication of this matter that her name was being used to bill for services without her knowledge. Additionally, she did not have any involvement in the assessment, treatment, or supervision for services provided to the client that was referenced in this complaint. Nor did she have any involvement in the agency's billing. It was noted that she relayed to the committee that she was not aware services were being billed under her license until after receiving this complaint, which prompted her to resign from the agency. Further, Dr. Stenhoff noted that the CBA discussed in an email from the agency's chief operating officer, Ms. Miller, that the agency does not imply or officially list Ms. Horton as a supervising LBA on the cases. The COO also stated that they used her name since she was the first BCBA contracted, thus the reason billing for her name. The email concluded with an apology that Ms. Horton is listed on the complaint and should not have been. Based on this information and interviewing Ms. Horton, the committee determined to make a recommendation to dismiss the complaint. I just want to note that the complaint against the two other respondents who were listed, Ms. Lepowski, Ms. Evans, were tabled by the CBA to obtain additional information and to request participation from various representatives of the agency as they were several concerns noted. So it is anticipated that those complaints will be reviewed by the committee in the coming months, and the board will see it a few months from now. But today, the board is only reviewing the recommendation for Ashley Horton's complaint, which the CBA has recommended dismissal. So this concludes my summary. I do see that Ms. Horton and her attorney are present if the boards have any questions for them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Any questions for Ms. Michelson at this time? All right, and I'm not seeing the complainant MD being present, so we will move on to Ms. Horton and her attorney, Michael Rain. Thank you both for being here. You may make a statement to the board, and then if you have any questions, you'll get to field them.
Thank you. This is Michael Rain, counsel for Ms. Horton. Ms. Horton is also present on the call. We simply ask that you follow the committee's recommendation and dismiss the case for the reasons we believe Ms. Michelson just outlined. We're here to answer any questions you may have, and we'll await your decision.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Horton or Mr. Rain? Hearing none, let's go into our discussion. Dr. Stewart.
Yes, I certainly believe that we should take the recommendation of our own committee on this, and we'll be happy to make a motion if the chair would entertain that.
Sure.
I move that we dismiss the complaint number 2428 against Ashley Horton.
Second.
Second by Dr. Medina. And for the record, I want to say what Ms. Michelson said. The other complaints are coming in through the pipeline. So this particular aspect of it is different from the other ones. And in my review of the records, I didn't see anything that Ms. Horton did or could have done that would have changed the situation. So I agree with the recommendation that came to us. So there's a motion to dismiss the complaint. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries. Thank you, Ms. Horton, and thank you, Mr. Rain.
Thank you, everyone.
Okay, let's go to number 8. Is that correct, Ms. Michelson?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding request from Mark Anderson, PhD, for the board to stay its investigation of pending complaint number 24-39 and review of his pending renewal application and inactive status request. Ms. Michelson, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To summarize, Dr. Anderson is the subject of a complaint in both Arizona and Nevada, which was filed by the same complainant regarding mostly identical allegations. One of the main allegations is related to a supplement that Dr. Anderson previously sold online and to clients, including the complainant, who is a former therapy patient of Dr. Anderson's. She resides in Nevada, where services were received. Dr. Anderson has been licensed in Nevada since 2005. The complaint was initially filed with the Nevada board in August of 2023 and then submitted to our agency approximately 6 months later. The complaint has not yet been adjudicated by the Nevada board. I don't have a timeline as to when their investigation may be completed. I would definitely encourage the board to inquire with Dr. Anderson's attorney, Ms. Carvis, today for an update regarding the latest information that he's received from the Nevada board. Dr. Anderson's attorney did submit a letter requesting that the board allow this matter to be considered and adjudicated first by the Nevada board, noting that they would provide us with an outcome of the Nevada matter within 10 days of final adjudication. Because we received this request, staff has not yet scheduled the case for the CSC's review. It's before the board today to consider whether to grant or deny the request to stay the investigation. If denied, it would follow the typical adjudication process, with the complaint being scheduled for the CSC's review in the coming months. The second part of this agenda item is Dr. Anderson's pending renewal application, which he submitted in August. With that renewal, we noted a request to change his license from active to inactive status. He represents that he's not practicing in Arizona at this time, and that is the reason for the request. If the board elects to stay the investigation until the other jurisdiction concludes their investigation, the board may want to consider holding off on making a decision regarding his pending renewal and the request to go on an active status until all complaints have been adjudicated, as this would be consistent with the board's practice in previous matters. So we'll need one motion with regards to the request to stay the investigation and then a second motion regarding the pending renewal. So this concludes my summary. Please let me know if there are any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Any questions for Ms. Michelson at this time? Hearing none, I see that Dr. Anderson is present, and I believe your attorney, Ms. Mandy Carvis, is here as well. Thank you for being here. Dr. Anderson, Ms. Carvis, you have some time to make a statement, and then you'll get questions.
Perfect. Thank you. As Ms. Michelson indicated, this complaint was made by a former patient from Nevada. These did not involve any services that were provided in Arizona. The same complainant prior to filing the Arizona board complaint filed a board complaint with Nevada, which is ongoing. As Ms. Michelson could attest, in this instance, the complainant continues to send hundreds and I think thousands of pages of supplemental material to the Nevada board. She's also sent a bunch of supplemental material to the Arizona board, so that is further delaying the Nevada process. I understand that that is ongoing, and they have requested some additional information from Dr. Anderson based on the 1,000-page of materials that she provided to the Nevada board. I'm obviously not representing him in Arizona, as I'm not licensed in Arizona, so we have separate counsel that is handling that matter. We believe, and I guess the only other thing I want to mention is that the supplement in question has not been available for purchase since late 2019 or early 2020. So this is, you know, a pretty late or outdated complaint as well. We believe that since this is a Nevada-based patient and the services were provided in Nevada, that it is most appropriate to allow the Nevada board to investigate and make a decision. And having the Arizona matter go forward simultaneously could result, in conflicting resolution. And again, since it's a Nevada-based patient with a physician who is licensed there, we think it would be most appropriate to allow Nevada to handle that. We would agree, obviously, as indicated in my initial response, to inform the Arizona board of the outcome of the Nevada case within 10 days of resolution or whatever period of time this board would like. We believe that that would be most appropriate. As to the pending renewal application and inactive status request, again, that was made because he is not practicing in the state of Arizona. He's practicing in Nevada. However, if the board has a procedure in place by how they typically handle that sort of thing with a pending complaint, we'll obviously abide by whatever the board typically does in that regard. But again, our primary request today is to stay this matter pending outcome of the Nevada matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Carvis. Any questions for Ms. Carvis? Dr. Caterina.
Yes, I don't know if maybe Dr. Anderson needs to answer this. We've said several times he's not practicing in Arizona. I see that he was listed as the director, or I'm not sure what the title was, of the Axiom Care Program. And I don't know if he has any supervisory therapeutic roles there or dealing with patients or supervising their therapists. Could that be explained?
I actually don't believe that Dr. Anderson is with us at the meeting. If he is, that would be news to me. I did not think he was available. To my understanding, I don't believe that that is an ongoing role with Axiom at this time. Yes, and I'm sorry, I just found that in my notes. He has not been affiliated with Axiom since February of 2024, so he no longer is engaged in that capacity here in Arizona.
So is our position, the position is that he is not providing any administrative or therapeutic or anything related to psychology in Arizona at this time?
Yes. Yes, doctor, that's correct.
Am I correct that he wanted to activate? What is his status about his license? He wants an inactive license or activate
license? His license is currently active since he is not practicing here. He was requesting as part of his renewal to go inactive status if that were an option.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Chairman Diner. And thanks for being here, Ms. Carvis. Ms. Carvis, I don't know if you're aware, Dr. Anderson's LinkedIn profile as of the end of September says he's still the chief operating officer for Axiom Care.
I'm not aware of that, but I can certainly tell him to take care of that. He certainly wouldn't be the only person who doesn't regularly update their LinkedIn, but I understand how that would be confusing. So I'm happy to instruct him to take care of that.
Yeah, the concern is, thank you for that. The concern is he talks about as COO, he's responsible for all elements of care that directly or indirectly touch patients.
I understand that. I can only speak to the fact that based on the information I have, that he's not been affiliated with Axiom since February of 2024. And that's the best information that I have available. I do understand how that would be confusing, and I will have him address that ASAP. I appreciate you bringing it to my attention.
Any questions for Ms. Carvis? Okay, hearing none, let's go into our discussion phase. So there are really two requests. One is the stay request, and the other one is the inactive status request. So I think we need to take the stay request first, as Ms. Michelson indicated. So is there any discussion in relation to the stay request? So I understand the sort of problems that our board will face when we are having a parallel prosecution or, parallel investigation alongside Nevada. And it's somewhat duplicative of what Nevada is already doing. So is there, do board members have any particular thoughts on the stay request as it stands? Dr. Katerina.
I know Ms. Michelson asked, maybe Ms. Carvis could let us know the status of the Nevada case right now. Do you have any information?
Yes, doctor, just that the investigation is ongoing. The complainant continues to submit hundreds and hundreds of pages of supplemental material as she's done to this board. So it's in process. I'm not familiar with how long a board investigation takes in Nevada. So that's the best that I can provide, which is why we indicated that we would be willing to provide this board with notification of a final adjudication of that matter within 10 days.
Do we know anything? Do they have a complaint screening committee? Has it gone past that?
I have no idea about the Nevada process beyond saying that the investigative process is ongoing.
And is he still practicing in Nevada?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Any discussion or motion? Okay, so maybe as a discussion item, the way I'm looking at this is, it's basically the same events or same, in sort of legal terms, the same transaction or occurrence, the common nucleus of operative fact that is giving rise to both the Nevada complaint and the Arizona complaint. And in these type of situations, at least my tendency is to have, whichever state has first jurisdiction. I mean, both Nevada has jurisdiction over this, both Arizona has jurisdiction over it. But Nevada's process has seemed to be at, one or two steps ahead of Arizona. So in that situation, my tendency would be to let Nevada complete its investigative process, its complaint adjudication process. And if Nevada concludes that, you know, this is a disciplinary matter under Nevada's statutes, then that's just an additional potential violation that this board in Arizona will consider at that time. But if Nevada chooses that there was no harm occurred or no disciplinary action is warranted, then that will inform this board's understanding of, you know, what to do with the matter before us. So I would be in favor of granting the stay because Nevada is going through this process already. But again, personal tendency. Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am in favor as well of granting this stay. I think it's consistent with actions taken in the past by the board. I also weigh my decision in that the complainant was in Nevada. This happened in Nevada where they were receiving services. So I do think it's appropriate to wait and see what Nevada rules with this complaint. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Denner. I certainly concur with the chair as well as with Dr. Medina, that Arizona stays the complaint until after the adjudication from the Nevada board.
Is there any discussion or motion? Dr. Stewart.
I move that we stay the complaint until the Nevada board has adjudicated the complaint in their state.
Second.
Second by Dr. Medina. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? None opposed. The motion carries.
And Mr. Chairman, I do believe that Mandy, we have heard your representation that you will keep us informed.
Absolutely. And I'm happy to provide an update within 10 days of final adjudication if that time frame is acceptable.
Okay, thank you.
So then the second component of this is the inactive status request. Any discussion about that? Dr. Katrin.
I have a question. How does that affect our decision, for example, if Nevada finds that he has active unprofessionally, would we treat him the same way if he were inactive or active? Would it make any difference?
He would still have a license, but it is on an active status. Historically, what this board has done is when there is a pending complaint, you do not grant the request to go inactive. His license would remain active in Arizona, even if the renewal time has come and gone. Because there is a pending complaint, you have not taken final action on the application, so it would remain active, and there would be no question of jurisdiction if you granted inactive and he didn't renew that.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Stewart.
I certainly agree with that, especially in light of what Dr. Scheidman pointed out, the LinkedIn Facebook profile is saying that he's, as of September 24th, 2024, continues to have responsibility, although that may be not accurate and that his operation or his connection with Axiom did indeed cease and desist in February. We don't have anything to support that. And so I just based on that, I think we need to keep the license active until such time that that's resolved. And also, an active status would, as Ms. Galvin pointed out, would allow us more easy access to handle complaints. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. I would agree with my colleagues here, and I would actually like to make a motion to not allow the inactive status.
Okay.
Is a second by Dr. Medina. Any discussion? All right, there's a motion to deny the request to change to inactive status. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Any opposed? None opposed, the motion carries. Thank you, Ms. Carvis.
Thank you very much, everyone. Have a nice weekend.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
This is Ms. Poe. I just had a question. Since there is a submitted pending renewal application for change to inactive status, is that application just going to sit in limbo then?
Yes, that's tabled until resolution of the complaint.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. Should we go to number 7, Ms. Pakkanen or Ms. Michelson?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We know that we're not going to be able to address all the items on today's agenda. We will lose quorum. There are a couple, 12 and 13, which we can, there's no consequences or implications for moving those to November. So let's see if 7 can be accomplished before we lose quorum.
Thank you. Okay, 7 is discussion, consideration, and possible action relating to initial case review of complaint number 24-28 against Mary Ann Lanzalota, PhD. And Dr. Medina is the lead on this. So Dr. Medina, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the summary for complaint number 24-38 against Dr. Mary Ann Lanzalota, holder of license number 826, issued in 1979. Complainant JT is involved in a contentious court custody proceeding with his ex-wife. Court proceedings have been ongoing since 2004. In June 2021, the court appointed Dr. Lanzalota as the therapeutic interventionist to assist with the reunification process between father and his eldest daughter, who was 17 and a half years old at the time the appointment occurred. The order specified that Dr. Lanzalota shall supply brief 90-day intervention summaries and that the TA fees shall be paid 65% by the father and 35% by the mother. Dr. Lanzalota submitted one report to the court dated January 2022, approximately 7 months following the appointment, noting that no additional services will be provided as daughter had recently turned 18. Reunification was not successful. In his complaint, JT cites that Dr. Lanzalota allowed mother to wrongfully delay the process and failed to inform the court, failed to consider the evidence confirming the mother's false accusations, and failed to inform the court of that and failed to comply with the order of appointment. That she failed to inform the court of the mother's noncompliance, portrayed father in a negative light, failed to hold one meeting with his daughter, canceled at the last minute one meeting, and provided a false explanation for canceling the appointment. In summary, JT alleges that Dr. Lanzalota did not take any meaningful action to reunite them and failed to give this case the timely attention it required. JT noted that in November 2023, the court found that Dr. Lanzalota wrongfully and unfairly portrayed JT in an extremely negative light in her report, omitting pertinent information in her one and only report to the court. Dr. Lanzalota's position is that she met the standard of care, relied in good faith upon the information she provided, and did her best to assist with mending father and daughter's relationship despite the very late appointment by the court. The relationship was already estranged at the time of Dr. Lanzalota's involvement. She noted that the previous interventionist had encouraged all participants to engage in meaningful individual therapy, but found that none of the parties had engaged in meaningful individual therapy. There is no evidence that her conduct was the cause of the failed reunification, nor that she fell below the standard of care or committed any acts of unprofessional conduct. Dr. Lanzalota acknowledges she did not complete the 90-day summaries, but it is her position that this did not prejudice the parties in any way. She is requesting that the board dismisses this complaint. During the CSC meeting on September 18th,
The committee unanimously voted to forward the complaint to the board for further review regarding a potential violation of ARS 32-2061 subsection 16O, providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards of practice. And this concludes my summary to the board.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. Any questions for Dr. Medina at this time? Hearing none, I see that complainant JT is here. Just as a matter of preliminaries, keep in mind that the board may go into executive session on any item listed on the agenda, according to ARS 38-431.03, subsection A2, to review confidential records, including the receipt and discussion of information or testimony that is confidential by state or federal law, or according to ARS section 38-431.03, subsection A3, to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. JT, thank you for being here. Please continue to use initials for yourself and any minors involved. You may make a statement and then we'll see if we have any questions for you.
Thank you for this opportunity to present evidence on how Dr. Lancelotta was negligent in her order of appointment on June 17th of 2021. A couple of the points that Dr. Medina presented was, number one, that neither party completed individual therapy prior to her appointment. That's incorrect. Me, the father, went to four individual sessions with Dr. Robin Hall, and as a result of that, that's why she was appointed by the court. So that's a misleading statement by Dr. Lancelotta. Number two, she did not resubmit her reports until after my attorney requested that she submitted reports, and she didn't file a report or a summary report until after the appointment had expired in January. Number three, Dr. Lancelotta will argue that the scope and authority was limited when the fact that the breadth of the scope of the appointment was very significant. Some of the points of authority that she had was as follows. She was to facilitate the development of, implement a court-ordered child-focused schedule for access. The TI never developed, implemented, or produced a schedule for access, despite repeated attempts from me, the father. The TI shall provide brief 90-day intervention summaries to the court, which we already know she failed to do that. She never did that. The TI has the authority to make requests, amend, and enforce court's order. The TI failed to do that as well. Should the appointee find that any party is acting in bad faith and not complying with the court's order, the appointee may recommend additional sanctions, which may include modifications of access and or contempt proceedings. Throughout the entire appointment, mother failed to comply with any of the orders of the appointment, and the TI failed to sanction the mother and or inform the court. Furthermore, the mother did not fill out her paperwork until July 20th of 2021. The first meeting was set up between Dr. Lancelotta and I on July 21st, 2021, which is approximately a month and a half after the order of appointment. She never informed the court. She never sanctioned the mother. Dr. Lancelotta set up a joint session between mother and I on August 17th. And during that session, mother lied about the following: father being domestically violent, mother not being convicted of domestic violence, mother intentionally leaving father off the medical and school records, mother changed the educational dance schools of the minor child without informing the father, mother criminally was convicted of child access interference. On August 26th, which is 2 months after the order of appointment, father's attorney sends the TI documentation to prove mother was indeed convicted of the aforementioned. The TI did not sanction the mother or inform the court. Bear in mind, again, this is 2 months after the order and there's only 4 months left before the appointment expires. On November 12th of 2021, mother informs the TI that she will no longer, and Gianna will no longer participate in the reunification process, and she will no longer pay the TI. The TI doesn't sanction or inform the court of mother's blatant disregard for the court order. On November 13th and 16th, father reminds all parties of the court order and what it states. The TI doesn't sanction the mother or inform the court with less than a month before the child turns the age of 18. On December 2nd of 2021, the TI informs the father we cannot move forward because mother was refusing to pay and she's suffering financial hardship due to the father not paying child support. On December 3rd, the father immediately provides proof yet again to the TI. Father was indeed current and ahead on all his child support payments, and the TI does not sanction mother or inform the court. This obviously meets the level of negligence. Throughout the reunification process, the father requested parenting plans, schedules, clear-cut objectives pursuant to the court order. Additionally, father repeatedly requested when he is going to be able to see his daughter, Gianna, 6 times via email and in every therapy session. Here are the dates that the father made those requests via email. July 29th, September 21st, October 23rd, October 29th, November 16th, December 3rd. The second point the TI is going to make, she's going to claim that both parties were resisting to the scheduling, and the court found this to be true of the mother, but not the father. The court's findings are as follows. Mother caused delays in the TI process. Mother presented the TI with unsubstantiated and unsupported claims about a history of domestic violence and abuse by father. Mother lied to the TI about her criminal conviction of domestic violence. Mother lied about her criminal conviction of access interference. Mother lied to the TI and said she was unable to pay the TI fees. Mother was able to pay the TI fees. Despite her claims to the contrary, given her bank account had a balance of over $40,000 at the time, she claimed she did not have the funds. Mother was not invested and reluctant to engage in the TI process or any efforts to improve father and Gianna's relationship. Bear in mind, this same evidence was presented.
Please summarize, JT. Please summarize.
Okay. In summary or in closing, I would like the board to know. The TI will claim that I blame the TI for the reason that Gianna and I didn't have a relationship. I blame the TI for being negligent, not following the court's orders, and fulfilling her obligations pursuant to the court order. As a result of her negligence and the TI, as a result of the TI's negligence, the mother was successful in alienating the father from the child. So in closing, I'd like the board to know this has been a highly contentious case due to mother's extreme parental alienating tactics and clinical diagnosis of being a covert narcissist by Dr. Cristiano. Dr. Cristiano also determined father had been a victim of extreme parental alienation by the mother. Yet Dr. Lancelotta conveniently leaves that out of her report, would lead this boy to believe father was removed from his children when in fact the opposite is true. The father was granted sole custody of both children. Father also wants the board to know and reiterate mother kidnapped Gianna, changed her identity, and lived on the land for approximately 2.5 years and was found guilty of contempt over 70 times, lied to the TI, lied to the court, lied to the minor children, and the TI never mentions any of this in her one and only summary report. The TI failed in every aspect of the court-ordered appointment. Therefore, the board should rule that the TI meets the standard of negligence and sanction pursuant to Arizona law. Thank you for this time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, JT. Any questions for JT from board members at this time? Hearing none, let's go to Dr. Lancelotta, and I believe you're represented by Mr. Carey. Thank you both for being here. Please make a statement, and then I'm sure we'll have questions.
Sure. Good morning, Chair, members of the board. This is Flynn Carey. You got a little flavor as to the approach to which the complainant approached reunification. This is essentially a 20-year campaign of settling scores. He has continued to be resistant to recommendations that Dr. Lancelotta made. And he seeks, I think in his statement even, about sanctioning mother to convert Dr. Lancelotta from a therapeutic interventionist into a judge. It's very important. It was very important to him that he be essentially exonerated from any responsibility for what happened with his daughter, despite there being multiple reports, including one from 2018, where there was a recommendation that maybe he needed to focus on his reunification with the younger child because of the irreparable harm that had been done previously in his attempt to reunify with his eldest daughter. The reality here is that the CSC moved this case over for the whole board to hear, and their concern was with the reporting. The reality, though, is that even one of the members of the CSC noted that failure to submit a 90-day report at a time when there was nothing really to report didn't rise to the level of discipline, and we share that position on this. The reality here is that I think what keeps getting missed, and not by the board, but in the complaint, is that there are two other people involved. There's mom and there's the daughter. And Dr. Lancelotta used her clinical judgment to determine that in this very short time period, daughter was not yet ready to reunify. And father in November insisted that he was there to have lunch with the daughter. And in fact, that was not even what was supposed to happen at that point. That was a time for him to read an apology letter that throughout the treatment, he refused to even call an apology letter because his insistence was that everyone needed to apologize to him. So you got a flavor for the contentious nature of this 20-year street fight in court. Really what the board needs to focus on is really a few things. First of all, I don't think the board wants to convert our TIs, our reunification folks, our limited focused assessment individuals into judges. It's not their job to go in and determine whether or not mom's the bad guy. Did mom interfere with the court process? Did mom kidnap a child? Her job is to receive information and then to determine a way in which the parties can potentially be reunified. This was a case in which she met the standard of care, and there did not appear to be in CSC any discussion whatsoever, or any concern, I would say, whatsoever, that she failed in the application of her science to this case. The concern remained on the 90-day report, and if you go back and look at the 90-day mark, despite the complaint from the complainant, this was progressing. It was progressing at an appropriate pace. And I think she would have been negligent if she had forced a young lady into a interaction with her father sooner than she was ready. The reality is, and we excerpted this in our most recent letter, but also throughout our materials, that there is so much dysfunction in this relationship that it would have been irresponsible for her to prize the complainant's position over the other two people involved. The bottom line here is that she met the standard of care. I understand the report wasn't filed, but the reality is her focus was attempting to at least lay some basic groundwork. So when this young lady turned 18, if there was even an opportunity for her to consider reunifying, it was there. It's not her job to dictate who's telling her the truth. Because that is the role of the court. And certainly down the road, the court did find that mother had not acted in good faith in certain ways, but that's the role of the court. That is not the role of the TI. Otherwise, you are encouraging you're encouraging essentially TIs to start playing as judges, and that's not their role. So what we would ask again is find that the 90-day report issue doesn't rise to the level of disciplinary, recognize that the standard of care was met, and we would suggest that a dismissal is an appropriate outcome in this case, and failing that, at most, a letter of concern about meeting a deadline.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. Could you or Dr. Lanzalota address the daughter's age at the time of the 90-day deadline, and what's her age right now?
She was 17 and a half when reunification started. So she would have been 17 and a half plus 90 days when that was due. And her age now, she's older because this case actually occurred in 2021. So she would be maybe 21, 22 at this point.
Thank you. And so after 18, is my understanding correct that the court would not really have jurisdiction over reunification because then, you know, it's an adult making decisions for themselves?
Yeah, Chair Dinar, actually this came up with Dr. Stewart. He had asked some questions about this as well. Family court only has jurisdiction over adults when they look back for child support purposes and some other limited purposes. They don't have any ability to compel an adult to participate in TI or reunification once they hit 18, which also raised the question, obviously, given how much water was under this bridge, whether it was reasonable to even think that reunification would be completed. I think Dr. Lanzalota can talk to you about her thoughts on it, which was essentially laying some foundation so that if this young lady, when she turned 18, wanted to have a more meaningful relationship with her father, she could. But she certainly, I don't want to take her role on this. And please feel free to chat with her if you'd like on those issues.
Thank you. Any questions for Dr. Lanzalota or Mr. Carey? Dr. Caterina? I'm sorry, actually. Yeah, okay. Go ahead, Dr. Caterina. I didn't see Dr. Seidman's hand up, so I apologize.
I had two just right now. On page 63, it says when she was given the order from the court appointing her as TI, it said that there's a section that says immunity, and it says that she has quasi-judicial immunity. Mr. Carey, do you know what that means? What is quasi-judicial?
Yeah, I can speak to this, and I'm sure either Heidi or Jennifer can jump in if I get this wrong. But my understanding is that when someone is court appointed by your board or court appointed and they're a member of or licensee of your board, there is an additional step that has to take place within the complaint review process before it can be forwarded on. And largely what happens is generally the clinicians on the board will look at it, the file, to see if on its face, if there is enough information to warrant going forward. But it's generally it's a stopgap in place to make sure that in family court cases, there's not just the reality is in family court cases, whichever party's unhappy is going to report the clinician. And so it's a little bit of a stopgap, and it just puts in an additional level of review by, I believe, three of your clinicians on the board or related to the board before it can turn into a mature complaint.
Okay.
It's not an indication, obviously, that there's a finding. It's just essentially, does it survive the initial triage process?
Okay. And the second, now, Dr. Lancelotto was not the first TI. Dr. Cristiano was the TI also.
Yes, there was reunification attempts made years prior. And in fact, a complainant included a report from that provider, and we cited to it extensively to establish why we thought that the standard of care, or why it would have been very difficult to meet any kind of reunification goals with this case.
Well, I was going to address this, and is it the standard of care? It was reported by the court that should be reported in 90 days. Is that really what happens? Is that the standard of care with other TIs? For example, Dr. Cristiano, do they typically do submit a report at 90 days, even if there's nothing new to report? Is that the standard of care? So anyone answer that? Mr. Carey, maybe you have any?
I can only answer from doing family court work is that the judge usually has discretion over what his or her temporary order or TI order would look like. So it's not there's not a mandatory law out there, if that's what you're asking, Dr. Caterina.
Well, no, I'm asking, is that typically, like, for example, did Dr. Cristiano give a report at 90 days if his order said that?
Yeah, I don't know what Dr. Cristiano did by way of I'm sorry, if we could ask the complainant to stop motioning. I would like to engage with the board, and it's not his time to speak.
Mr. Carey, the floor is yours. You may.
Thank you.
Answer the question.
Every judge will do it on how they choose to do it. Essentially, I don't have anything. I can't really speak to the pattern or practice of the court on that.
But we don't know what his orders were and if he complied. I'm trying to see what's standard. Okay.
Thank you. I understand.
Dr. Seidman.
Thank you, Chairman Diner. Dr. Lanzalotti, thanks for being here today. And Mr. Carey, thanks for being here today as well. Dr. Lanzalotti, I have a question for you. How many cases as a TI have you done in your career? Just approximately?
Oh, I probably have done over 100, maybe 150.
And this seems like an atypical one for you, if I read the materials correctly. Is that true?
Atypical in what way?
Well, the age of the minor, the contentiousness of the parties, and other variables. Is that true or no?
I would say that it was one of the more complex and challenging cases that I've had. For all those reasons, the length of conflict between the parents, the history between the parents, sure, the age of the child, and the time that I had.
Sure. And I'm curious, did you ever consult with a colleague about this case to get some guidance? You know, especially when you have a 90-day court order that you're court ordered to provide, even though there may not be much information to provide them?
I did not.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Dr. Lancelotto. Is it customary to notify the court when one of the parties is non-compliant?
It is customary depending on the level of non-compliance.
Okay. So what would be something reportable, I guess?
So something that I would have reported is if after
30 or more days, one of the parties was not completing paperwork or responding to my calls, requesting updates about where the paperwork was, or not submitting a retainer or refusing to make appointments. For me, that would have risen to the level of non-compliance.
So the mother in this case saying, I'm not going to continue, I'm not going to engage anymore, is not a level of non-compliance that warrants reporting?
Well, actually the mother did then comply. Shortly after that, I met with her and she got back on board with the reunification process.
Right, but she declined to engage for at least a few weeks, which when you have such a short amount of time to move the case forward, I think it becomes then significant to demonstrating noncompliance. That is my only question. Thank you.
Dr. Flint.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is also for Dr. Lanzalotta. Hello, thank you for being here. Your assertion, as I'm hearing it, is that you didn't file the report as court ordered because there was nothing substantial to report. I just want to get clarification. In cases like this, isn't having no movement clinically significant?
In my opinion, there had been some movement. At the 90-day time, both parents were scheduling appointments and both parents were reading the book that I had suggested, and also in the process of preparing the letters that I asked them to prepare.
So you just chose not to do the 90-day then, even though now you're saying there was actually something to report, or you forgot that that was in the order? I'm just trying to gain clarity on the decision-making process.
Since progress was being made, in my opinion, I felt that I would have only notified the court that progress was being made and I was working with the parents. So in my thought process was that there was nothing significant to report.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So Dr. Lanzalotta, I know there was the board order saying in 90 days, submit a report. The contents were obviously up to you. And you also answered to Dr. Seidman's question that you have done 150 of these. Is it your practice that if you don't have anything significant to report, you do not submit a report? Or is it your practice that, when the 90-day deadline is approaching, you might ask the court for an extension, might give the court some kind of an informal information that the report is being drafted or there is nothing significant to report? What's your usual practice?
So I might ask the court for an extension, or I might maybe submit a report at 100 days. That is not, it's not necessarily that I would notify the court at exactly 90 days about what was occurring.
And what has been the court's response to that practice? Just courts in general, and what has been this court's response to not meeting the 90-day deadline?
That really hasn't been an issue with the court. There are times that a judge will set a status conference and request that a report is done. In other words, a judge might set a status conference for the 90-day report and then ask that the report be submitted 7 days or 10 days prior to that conference. And in those cases, yes, there is always a report available to the court before the status conference.
Dr. Carina?
Yes. I just had a quick question, Dr. Lancelot. You said that I would feel there was no movement if the one party hadn't submitted paperwork for a month. If JT is correct, you said that you were appointed on June 17th and the paperwork from the mother came in July 20th. So that is a month. Is that correct?
Yes, as soon as I was appointed, I reached out, father contacted me, and then I reached out to mother for her contact information. And then she submitted her paperwork. I believe I had the dates in the report that I had written. So there might have been a month, yes, but during that time period, I believe father was out of town part of that time. And I believe mother knew that. And I think at one point she even mentioned that she knew he was out of town and was delaying her paperwork because she didn't think anything was going to begin.
Well, he could have met with you. He was in town.
He met with me as soon as he returned from...
Mother could have met with you. Right?
Prior, yes, she could have.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Seidman?
I'm still struggling a little bit with the documentation. So your normal and customary practice is to submit a 90-day report, 90 days, 100 days, whatever it is. It was months later until you submitted a report in this particular case, especially knowing that the timeline was so shrunk. I'm just not understanding why this was a practice in this particular case, knowing the timeline was so narrow. And that's directed toward you, Dr. Lancelotto.
I was still working with the parties after the 90 days with the hope of having something significant to report, such as the child has begun to be amenable to meeting, you know, with father, or that I conducted joint sessions with father and child, and, you know, they're talking about reconciling in some way, whatever that might look like. It could mean even having beginning contact by texting or meeting for a coffee. So my goal still was to be focusing on reunifying them and trying to create some positive experiences until before she was 18 years of age.
I believe that very clearly. I do believe that. However, there was a court order for you to inform the court. So you're working collaboratively with the court. And so again, it's just surprising to me that your normal and customary is to do it within 90 to 100 days. And this particular case took so long for you to write a report and at the expense of both parties.
Yeah,
so I think in the interest of time, I think that was Dr. Seidman, was that a question or a statement?
Probably a statement for the record. Thank you.
Thank you. So I think in the interest of time, I want to move into the discussion phase of this. So I think based on what we have heard, there is enough to say that in this initial case review, the allegation that the psychologist engaged in unprofessional conduct by current standards of practice. That's the allegation, 16-0. I think there's enough here to move this to an informal interview. But again, that's my personal understanding based on the review and based on the colloquy that happened. Dr. Medina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with your assessment. The outcome of the proceeding is not what is in question here. It's the procedure, what happened between the cases assigned, and there is no longer jurisdiction, right? So, well, yeah, there was a misreport at 90 days. I think it had bigger, ramifications. And then there was a request from one of the attorneys, I believe it was the complainant's attorney in November, to please submit a report. And again, that was ignored. So there was a failure to inform the court of mother's noncompliance after the mother told Dr. Lancelota she would not cooperate anymore with the investigation. The complainant's attorney, like I mentioned, in mid-November, highlighting the mother's noncompliance and urging Dr. Lancelota to please provide a summary report to the court. The court gives Dr. Lancelota the authority to seek enforcement from the court when there is noncompliance. And that was not used here in this case, knowing how pressed for time this case was. I think that, you know, there's also the payment issue was brought up. The complainant had offered to pay all costs if the mother refused to pay, which was an excuse that the mother used to stop complying with the case. And complainant had warned Dr. Lancelota that the mother would use that as an excuse. There is just this sense that when, you know, we read everything together, that Dr. Lancelota was allowing the mother to delay the process without dutifully informing the court from the moment mother takes a month to return paperwork. It was just the initial questionnaire. There was an issue with the meeting with the daughter and the misunderstanding with that. So when I think about duty, right, it seems that time was just passing and passing, and that perhaps, I don't know, if running the clock was part of the motivation or what was going on, but I think there was a duty to inform the court of what was happening. I don't think the process is customary. And those are my thoughts on this case. And I do agree with you that it needs to go to a formal interview. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. I think it's the reporting that I'm thinking about, because if there is a court order, I mean, you either ask for an extension or, you know, you inform the court, okay, I don't have anything to report right now. I can provide like a quick, you know, one paragraph thing. Okay, these are the things I have been doing, but my report is forthcoming. Please give me an extension. I mean, that's customary to me. What is not customary to me is just ignoring the 90-day deadline. I mean, courts, usually juvenile courts and judges, are very sensitive to family law issues. They are sitting not just on this one case, but, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of other cases. So there's some reason behind a court saying, I want a 90-day report and maybe I want a 180-day report, et cetera. And you can't just ignore those deadlines. I mean, as I'm an attorney practicing in Arizona, and I would never think of ignoring a court deadline. I would be terrified of ignoring a court deadline. And I did not see that sort of contrite attitude, let's say, from Dr. Lancelota. She's like, oh, you know, maybe I submit something to the court when I feel like it. And that isn't the kind of answer I was looking for. So there's definitely enough here to move the case on to informal interview. Does it rise to disciplinary action? Probably not. It's probably just a warning. Probably just, you know, enough remedial steps need to be taken for Dr. Lancelota to realize that you can't just ignore court deadlines like that. For multiple reasons. And in this particular case, you know, ignoring that deadline led to some certain downstream effects on the case. And we can't afford to have that become customary practice in the state. So with that, I'll make a motion to, let's see, what would be the motion? Move this case to initial informal interview based on the 16-0 allegation.
Second.
There's a motion and a second by Dr. Stewart. Yes, Ms. Galvin.
I would ask the board to consider, are there any potential violations with respect to the ethical code and compliance with court orders and adhering to, you know, mandates. I'm not entirely certain if that fits, but I would like to give notice if that's a possible violation.
So I have the ethics code in front of me, but under DD, what would be the ethics? Yes, Dr. Medina.
The only, I looked at it, I thought maybe DD 2.03, psychologists undertake ongoing efforts to develop and maintain competence. That would be, I tried to look for something more applicable, but I couldn't find.
And there may not be anything. I was just asking the board to consider. So thank you.
Dr. Stewart?
I don't think there is anything else of substance to this other than the missed deadline by the courts. Okay. I do not think it rises to a level of disciplinary action at all. And I had taken that stance in the screening committee. But the committee has convinced me that the record keeping is important, and I agree with that. And that's the only thing that I'm hanging my hat on.
Thank you.
All right, so there is a motion, just the 16-0. Any further discussion? Okay, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? None opposed, the motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you, JT, Mr. Carey, and Dr. Lanzalora for being here.
Thank you.
So I think we're quickly going to run out of time in 4 minutes. In the interest of not leaving anything half complete, I'll use my moderator's privilege to adjourn the meeting. We are adjourned. It's 11:26 a.m.
Thank you,
everybody.
Thank you.